I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times. Moss-Cohen. Let me read from the last paragraph of Walter Isaacson's new biography of Albert Einstein. He writes, "He was a loner with an intimate bond to humanity, a rebel who was suffused with reference. And thus it was that an imaginative, impertinent patent clerk became the mind reader of the creator of the cosmos, the locksmith of the mysteries of the atom and the universe." Much has been written about Einstein over the years, but Isaacson had access to private letters and papers that were made available in 2006. This book, Einstein, His Life and Universe, explores, among many things, his childhood, his relationship with his two wives and children, even his extramarital affairs. Isaacson juxtaposes Einstein's sometimes messy personal life with his groundbreaking scientific theories about the nature of the universe. He also says that Einstein's rebellious nature, his creative spirit, and his awe of the universe gave him a unique advantage and perspective. Albert Einstein was also a bona fide celebrity of his day, treated to parades, hounded by paparazzi, and given headline treatment. Well, we invited Walter Isaacson to join us today on Radio Times to talk about Einstein and this new book. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He was the chair and CEO of CNN and was the managing editor of Time magazine. His previous biographies include Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, A Biography. Walter Isaacson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Boy,
good morning.
Great to be back with you, Marty.
Well, thank you so much.
Back in Philadelphia.
Nice to have you back with us. And is there a connection between, in your mind, Kissinger, Franklin, and Einstein?
Yes, what I've always been interested in and tried to write about is how people's minds work. You know, some people write about military heroes or sports heroes or people of great character like George Washington. To me, the connection between intelligence and common sense and creativity and actually doing something useful, and sometimes the connections are there and sometimes they aren't, is what fascinates me. So I've always wanted to write about smart people and whether they had enough common sense and creativity to be great people.
And we could spend an hour certainly going back over Kissinger and Franklin, but let's focus in on Einstein. What's so interesting to read and actually to be reminded of is what a celebrity he was.
You know, it's amazing. It was a new age of celebrity just being born. He was a perfect person for it because World War I ends, and the world is kind of eager for somebody who transcends all the politics. And just as World War I ends, a English Quaker named Arthur Eddington decides to prove whether Einstein's right or wrong. Because Einstein's theory of relativity has one great test to it, which is gravity will bend a light beam. And of all the complicated things in physics, everybody can get their mind around that one, which is, okay, you know, is energy equals MC squared? Will gravity bend a light beam? Or will it not bend the light beam? And so they send a expedition out into the South Atlantic, and they photograph all of the stars, and then they wait for the solar eclipse and see, as the light goes by the sun from the distant stars, whether it bends. And he turns out to be right. There's a headline in the New York Times. I mean, it's a "Lights All Askew in the Heavens, Men of Science More or Less Agog, Einstein Triumphs." And he becomes this awesome super celebrity.
And is it because, I mean, and again, it's sort of hard to imagine someone, maybe Carl Sagan, someone had some degree of that, but it's just hard to imagine in 2007 that a scientist, even of his stature, would have the kind of public interest in who they were.
Oh, yeah, it was so many things coming together. First of all, it was the most amazing theories in all of science. And despite the fact that people are slightly, and shouldn't be, intimidated by science, these were theories you could understand, that energy and mass were connected, that gravity bends light, that time slows down the faster you move. So everybody could sort of see what he was talking about. Plus, he had that wild halo of hair,
yes,
those piercing eyes. He talked in wonderful quips. He had radiated humanity. And everybody thought he was a fount of all wisdom. Plus, he was a secular saint for Jews, just as anti-Semitism was rising in Europe. So you have so many things coming together to make Einstein a symbol of freedom in an age of oppression, of science triumphing over politics, everything you could possibly want. He arrives at the opening of City Lights, one of the great movies, with the only other celebrity close to him in public stature, and that's Charlie Chaplin.
Right.
And they come there, and there's 10,000 people there. They're cheering as they go in. And Chaplin says to them, they cheer you because they don't understand you. They cheer me because they understand me. And, you know, I think Charlie Chaplin and Albert Einstein became icons in an age of celebrity, but for in Einstein's case, for good reason.
Well, let's go to these.
Probably in Chaplin's case, too. Well, I did not mean to insult Charlie Chaplin.
Indeed, and I love that that quote. But let's go to these personal papers. They were released last year. You obviously use them, include them as part of this book. What is the Einstein that emerges for you from these papers?
What emerges is that instead of being a cold, aloof, absent-minded professor, this is a flesh and blood human being with incredible passions, gets angry, loves people, has fights with his family, and especially in the year of 1915, it's where some of these papers have come out, and it explains his divorce from his first wife who had helped him with special relativity 10 years earlier. Him falling in love with his first cousin. I mean, this is a soap opera you would never put on TV. And his first cousin helping nurse him because he can't get food during World War I when he's a professor in Berlin and, you know, his stomach is giving him problems. He's trying to do the greatest and most elegant theory in the history of science, which is general relativity. He's in a race to do it, and his kids are 8 years old and 11 years old, and writing him these plaintive letters from Switzerland because he's not coming to visit. And you say, oh my goodness, this isn't, you know, just some distant genius. This is a guy who is really juggling a lot of things, and you see the connection between his personality, his politics, his passions, and his science.
Well, and what really struck me is here he's trying to understand or create this unified theory about the universe, the cosmos, and nothing in his family life, you know, fits any kind of unified theory. I mean, it's chaotic. It's messy, like most people's family lives.
It is messy. You know, some people say to me, and I did it with, you know, after poor Ben Franklin, because he wasn't exactly husband of the year either.
No.
And my wife said, why do you keep picking people who don't, you know, get along with their families very well? I said, well, it's a bit of a coincidence. But, you know, every now and then it's nice to remind ourselves that these aren't people made of bronze or marble who are on pedestals. These are people who sometimes had trouble with their kids. And then they reconcile with them. And I find that about Einstein, you know, just so interesting how his personal life intersects with his scientific work and everything else.
Well, again, in trying to sort of not impose order, but understand order in the universe and then leading a disordered life.
He believed that there were underlying laws in the universe. And ever since he was age 4, when his dad gives him a compass when he's sick in bed, and Einstein said chills went through his body as he looked at that compass needle. Now, you and I probably remember getting a compass when we were a kid. You say, hey, cool. And then about 2 minutes later, it's lost its sight. He spent his whole time saying, there's some force field that makes that compass needle move. And that notion of an electromagnetic and gravitational fields, unseen fields in the universe, until his death in 1955, he's still trying to figure out how these force fields work.
And this is a 4 or 5-year-old beginning to think these very profound and lofty thoughts.
The way to encourage those of us and who are parents is, you know, Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid. You know, he was thinking some lofty thoughts when the dad gave him a magnet or a compass, but he was very slow in learning how to talk.
Yeah.
His family consulted a doctor because they were worried about his verbal ability. The family made dubs him the dopey one in the family. But I think it helps him think in pictures. And everything he does, from starting with that compass needle and trying to picture what a field, a force field, would look like, and then at age 16, looking at light waves and the equations for light waves, Maxwell's equations, as a 16-year-old, say, I wonder what it would be like to ride alongside a light beam and try to catch up with it. There he is doing what he calls thought experiments, which are sort of what you and I would call daydreaming, unless we're Einstein, in case you get to call them thought experiments.
But this idea of thinking in pictures, which is, I mean, allows someone to have a certain kind of imagination or expresses a certain kind of imagination.
And also to think out of the box. I mean, here's a guy who thinks in pictures. So every other scientist knows that time is absolute. Newton has told us this in the Principia, that it marches along step by step without regard to anybody's observing it. And he's a patent examiner, a third-class patent examiner, trying to figure out these patent applications for synchronizing clocks in Switzerland. Because, you know, the Swiss, they were kind of obsessed with getting the clock synchronized in Bern and, you know, and Zurich. And they would use, you know, telegraphic devices and radio signals to make sure the clocks were synchronized. And Einstein says, yeah, and those signals travel at the speed of light.
Hmm.
But if you're moving real fast, what you consider to be synchronous at the exact same time will be different from somebody who's standing on the train platform and not moving with the train. And so he thinks of what happens in a train if you're moving fast, how you would see two lightning strikes differently from somebody on the platform.
And imagining it, seeing it.
And he sees it. He pictures it in his head. And if you read his great paper on special relativity, 1905 paper, one of the four or five papers he does on that revolutionized the science, it's not a heavy-going math paper. He's drawing the pictures for you. He's talking about, imagine what it means to say a train comes into the station at 7. It simply means that you're looking at the light from a watch and the hand hits 7 when the train gets to the station. And you're thinking, oh, I get it. He's picturing this for me.
What do you think? And he was a pretty good musician. His mother
was a musician
as well. Do you think that also fed his creativity and allowed him to either see things in an unusual way?
Yes, absolutely. His father gives him the compass as a gift when he's a young kid, and his mother gives him a violin. And he ends up loving the violin and becomes a very good violinist. I mean, even does concerts, not obviously professional. And he said with Mozart, he felt Mozart didn't compose his music. He plucked his music from the harmony of the spheres. He plucked it from the universe. And Einstein said, that's what I try to do with my theories. Mm. I'm not trying to compose things as much as to just feel the harmony and pluck it from nature. And whenever he would have a problem, he's sitting there in 1915 with the whole family breaking apart, the war going on, trying to generalize relativity, sitting in this apartment in Berlin, and he'd just get up and start playing Mozart on the violin whenever he had problems.
Hmm. We're almost up on a break here, but he said, and I mean, I love this, imagination is more important than knowledge.
That's the entire credo, and that's the theme of the book, is we got to remember we're not just cramming knowledge down our kids, we're trying to make them imaginative.
And I think of creativity is making connections.
Creativity is being able to see connections, but also see where there aren't connections, where you jump out of the box that everybody's been in for centuries. And every one of Einstein's great discoveries, from quantum theory to relativity theory, is thinking out of the box that other people had gotten us into. That's the imagination and creativity that he said was more important than knowledge.
Well, I'll tell you what, a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. Walter Isaacson is our guest today on the show, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Einstein, subtitled His Life and Universe. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Elder Hostel, a not-for-profit adult education organization, proudly supports WHYY. Elder Hostel encourages you to join them on a day of discovery at historic Yellow Springs Village. It's an opportunity to meet watercolorists, painters, and sculptors from Chester Springs Studio and view hundreds of jury-selected works. Day of Discovery one-day programs start May 1st. Registration and full details are available at www.elderhostel.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
You can't sort of use that excuse, oh, I don't know anything about money.
When it comes to managing your finances, Michelle Singletary won't let you pass the buck.
You need to educate yourself about what you need to do in addition to asking me.
Let Michelle help you find your own path to prosperity.
I know you want this money.
Michelle Singletary and Your Money, Tuesdays on NPR's Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Mendelssohn Club presents Mendelssohn's oratorio Elijah with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia and soloists William Stone, Layla Clare, Lori Gratis, and Stuart Neal. 8 p.m. Saturday, April 21st at First Baptist Church, 17th and Sansom Streets, Philadelphia.
For tickets or more information, 215-893-1999 or mcchorus.org. Mendelsohn Club supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about Albert Einstein today on the show. That's the subject of my guest's new book, and it's called Einstein, His Life and Universe. And my guest is Walter Isaacson. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's written biographies of Benjamin Franklin and Henry Kissinger. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to move ahead, but I'm also interested in having you talk a bit about his rebellious nature, because I think this is also part of his character, part of his personality.
You're absolutely right, and it's also part of his genius.
Yeah.
Two things make him a genius: his ability to think in pictures, and I hate to say this to the parents, you know, it's good that he's creative, but he defies authority, you know, runs away.
At every turn, doesn't he?
At every turn, he's able to, you know, cause one headmaster to kick him out of school and another to amuse us historians by saying this Einstein will never amount to much. Even when he gets, you know, he flunks the first entry exam into the Zurich Polytech, which is the second best college in Zurich. It's not like he's one of the great geniuses right off, although he is, but they don't know it. But once he finally gets in, all three of his major professors get annoyed at him because he says a useful contempt for authority has been my mantra, and the rest of my life I defy authority, and that's why I think differently. Now, that's always good to celebrate. I do like to caveat it for those of us with, you know, kids in school, that actually listening to authority is an important thing to do too, and especially if you're not really Einstein.
I was going to say, especially for those of us that
yeah,
are not
some
Einstein.
People aren't Einstein.
But do you think there's a connection, because he wanted to break with convention? I mean, he wanted to challenge orthodoxy, but think of his contemporaries: Freud, Picasso, Stravinsky. I mean, these were also people working in and around Einstein's time who were challenging the conventions within their fields.
Absolutely right. I do a lot on this in the book because something happens every now and then in history. It happens during the Renaissance, where in all fields people change the way of looking at things. It happens with the Enlightenment, when all of a sudden Newton's theories are reflected in Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. And it happens again at the beginning of the 20th century with the birth of modernism.
Mm-hmm.
And what people do is they break classical bonds. Einstein called it zwang, which means a constraint or a bond. He said, I hate any bonds like that. And people sort of mixed up relativity with relativism. Einstein was never a relativist, but it all becomes part of that all of our perceptions are relative, depending on your, you know, viewpoint and things. And so you look at a Picasso or a Kandinsky or others in the art world painting from different frames of reference. You look at Schoenberg or Stravinsky breaking the classical bonds in music, so they try things differently. James Joyce calls himself the literary interpreter of Einstein because he plays with space and time, and so does Proust. So all of this birth of modernism happens between, you know, 1900 and 1921, which is right when Einstein is doing relativity.
Let's talk about Milova Marić.
Yep, that's his first wife.
They meet as students.
Milova Marić is an incredibly interesting woman, a brooding, melancholy, deeply intelligent Serbian girl who wants to become a physicist.
Unusual.
To put it mildly, even it's unusual even in these times, as Larry Summers will remind you, unfortunately. But, you know, she can't even get into the Zagreb Academy as a kid because she's a girl. But her father is an army officer and forces them to take his daughter that she's so proud of. And she goes to all the all-male academies in Serbia and finally becomes the only woman at the Zurich Polytech studying physics. And she and Einstein fall madly in love. It is a passionate love relationship with the letters. I mean, you know, "You set my pillow on fire" is about the only thing I can quote on national public radio.
"My little witch," he calls her at some point.
Yeah, with a lot of other things he says that, you know, can't go over the broadcast airwaves or the FCC will come down on us. Beautiful letters. They fall in love. They go for a hike around Lake Como when they first meet, days on end, and she gets pregnant. They have an illegitimate daughter, Lee Zurl, who's a great mystery, lost to history, because they put her up for adoption, and it's unclear what happens to her, but I deal with that in the book.
Yeah.
And they can't get married at first because he can't get a job when he graduates from the Zurich Polytech. He has, you know, gotten all these professors all mad up. None give him recommendations. None give him a job. He can't get an assistant professorship or a fellowship or anything. And he finally, 2 years later, gets his first real job, which is as a third-class examiner in the patent office. So they get married the very next week because he finally has a job. And she helps him with those 1905 papers.
Helps him write, helps him think through.
You know, this is a great controversy
in history, and
it's been in history, and I wrestle with it a lot. And I don't think it does Mileva Maric any great credit to give her more due than she deserves. So I try to get it exactly right. I look at every week what they were writing, what the letters say, what papers, what drafts he did. I do not think that she comes up with any of the basic concepts of relativity. She helps with the math because she's probably better at that point
That's
at math than he is, or at least more meticulous. He's sloppy in his math. He's a better mathematician and eventually becomes a great mathematician with general relativity. But he's a little bit sloppy in his early drafts of the papers. She checks the math in the great 1905 paper on special relativity, works with him on the other papers. And I go through the whole controversy because every now and then they call it R theory in one of the letters. So I try to say, how much is it really a joint theory and how much is it she's a sounding board? I mean, what she did most of all is put up with him. I mean, he was not exactly the easiest of husbands. And so they end up drifting apart after a while. I mean, he's not easy. She's not easy. And, you know, the heart is a dark forest,
yes,
as they say. So it's hard to know who's right and who's wrong. She's very melancholy. She actually has schizophrenia and is institutionalized a bit. He is not the nicest person in the world once he falls out of love. He was passionately in love. So they drift apart, and he wants a divorce, and he can't afford it. And finally he says to her, one of these days, one of those papers is going to win the Nobel Prize.
These are the papers of 1905, that famous year.
Famous miracle year of 1905. He said, one of these days, one of those papers will win the Nobel Prize. And when it does, if you give me a divorce, you get the money. And she thinks about it. She's smart. She thinks about it a week. She consults with Fritz Haber, who's a great scientist and a lawyer. And she takes the wager. They draw up the documents. It's not until 1922 that they finally announce his Nobel Prize. But she gets the money, and she ends up buying three apartment buildings in Zurich. So they end up getting friendly again after that. I would say all is well that ends well, although it was very tempestuous, their relationship.
Well, including it, I guess one of the darkest part of their relationship is that he draws up a series of conditions for their relationship.
You include
this.
Yeah, these were in the papers. Yeah.
And these were in the papers as you read them and saw them.
Yeah, you can read them. Yeah, read them, some of them.
Well, let's see. You will obey the following points in your relations with me. And this is Einstein writing to his first wife. You will not expect any intimacy from me, nor will you reproach me in any way. You will stop talking to me if I request it. You will leave my bedroom or study immediately without protest if I request it. You will undertake not to belittle me in front of our children, even though words, blah, 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 blah. I mean, this gives you...
Yeah, it shows he is very, very cold when he had fallen out of love and they were having a very, very bad relationship. To her credit, she accepts that at first and then thinks about it a day and says, forget it. And she leaves him.
Right.
And she takes the kids and moves back to Zurich. And, you know, all I can say about Einstein is that it shows he's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
He does make up with her. He makes up with the kids. He supports her. He gives her money. He stays in her apartment in Zurich, 10 years later when he goes to visit Zurich. So they do reconcile, but as I said at the beginning of the show, it shows he's not a cold, aloof, distracted, absent-minded scientist. He's a passionate, flesh-and-blood, hot-blooded human being.
Well, and like in all relationships that fall apart, reconciling those early passionate letters with this cold...
Yeah.
Order to his wife.
Yeah.
It's painful to read. How
can he done that? Mm-hmm. And then I'll look at some of the people who asked me that, and I say, yeah, did you ever know anybody like that? And they sort of taken aback because it probably, sometimes they're like on their third wife, on their third wife or something. And you realize, okay, we're all human. Mm-hmm. In the case of Einstein, his genius is a bit 10 times greater, and some of his human flaws. But he does become a genial, nice person. He never you know, withholds any support. He's not very materialistic. When he starts making real money, he's always sending it to his kids, his first wife, to his family. So he had his pluses and minuses, mm-hmm. but he, as I say, like Ben Franklin, he's not going to win the Family Man of the Year award this year.
And that's Walter Isaacson, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's a biography of Einstein, or Albert Einstein, I should say. It's called Einstein, His Life and Universe. And our guest, Walter Isaacson, did write a biography of Benjamin Franklin, also a biography of Henry Kissinger, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. I should add, he was the chairman and CEO of CNN and former managing editor of Time magazine. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Going back to this time that he spent in the patent office where he was doing these thought experiments, do you think it was something about the boredom of that time and perhaps even sort of the roteness of his work where he could do that on the one hand but allow this imagination, this creativity to think these interesting and, of course, breakthrough thoughts?
No, I actually think he was lucky to be working at the patent office, not because it was boring, but because it was interesting. He got to look at different applications and try to picture the underlying theoretical reality. And, you know, Switzerland was just going on to standard time zones at the time. And the Swiss, being Swiss, were kind of obsessive about making sure the clocks worked and stuff. And so they had 70 applications, I think, between 1902 and 1905 for just devices that would synchronize clocks in distant cities. And all of them had one thing in common, which is they used signals that traveled at the speed of light, whether it was a radio signal that did it or a telegraph signal or an electrical pulse or light signals or whatever. And Einstein is trying to figure out what happens when signals travel at the speed of light and you're trying to synchronize clocks. And he has a wonderful boss named Haller who says, question every premise, always be skeptical, never rely on received wisdom. You know, I sometimes
think that's perfect advice for someone like Albert
Einstein.
Exactly.
Everything about that time in the patent office, even coming out of the door of the patent office and seeing the famous Bern clock tower with the trains that speed right under the clock tower to get into the station. And there he is doing thought experiments with what would it be like to be in a speeding train? Would time slow down for you and stuff? And so I love to do the thought experiment of, had he been an acolyte in the academy, had he been a junior professor at a university and had to conform to what his senior professors thought and teach the conventional wisdom, I'm not sure he would have made the great leap to relativity the way he could do it as a patent clerk.
Going back to his family, and what's so interesting is, of course, juxtaposing these ideas, these theories that he had about the universe and this family life that he had. And there's a scene in which he's working on one of these important theories, and his son is writing him letters saying, you know, being mad at him because of Christmas problems. And
it's
again, it's a painful, but also I think important lesson about people, famous people and their families or their private
and
life.
Compartmentalizing
and exactly.
It's 1915, the very end of October, and Einstein is just about to come up with and is wrestling with what is the most elegant theory in all of science, which is the general theory of relativity, which is that, you know, gravity is just the curvature of space, things you can picture, but he's trying to get the math and everything with it. And it's a terrible time. You know, he's having fights with his family. As I say, World War One is raging and stuff. And it's hard to tell these, as I say, the heart and the dark forest. But I do think the kids are being used as a pawn. As much as I try to be sympathetic to Mileva Maritz, she's clearly helping the 8-year-old and 11-year-old write some of these plaintive letters. And at one point, she gives the older boy a set of very expensive skis. And for a Christmas present. In fact, nobody quite knew what the present was. We knew that Einstein had gotten mad about something, but the new letters say that she had bought a set of skis and said, that's your Christmas present, but you have to get your dad to pay for them.
Yikes.
And so Hans Albert, the 11-year-old, writes to Albert Einstein. Hans Albert's in Zurich, writes to his dad in Berlin, right when all this is going on, in the middle of World War One, where he can't come visit very easily because you can't cross the border, saying, you promised you'd come for Christmas, And Mom said you'd pay for the skis she got for us, and they're 70 francs. And he writes a brutal letter saying that's far too expensive. I'll send you money, but that's far too much of a luxury. Plus, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it down for Christmas because the borders are closed and I'm working. And he says, I'm working so hard, I'm getting no sleep. I hardly stop to eat. And you see the struggle that's happening then. Fortunately, a few months later, he's actually published his theory. It is the greatest theory of all. The war has started to recede. He is able to go visit his sons. They go hiking together in the mountains. So, like a lot of life, there's ups and downs.
Now, he does have another marriage, ends up marrying his cousin.
First cousin,
a woman named Elsa. How would you compare that second marriage to the first? Because she seems almost motherly in a way.
Yeah, she's motherly. They had fallen in love when, as a cousin, in 1914, 15, 16, she was taking care of him, cooking for him, because in World War I Berlin, it was hard to get food if you were a normal person. And if you were an Einstein, you're not standing in line waiting to get bread and stuff. And so she would help him get food, cook for him, you know, help nurse him back to health when he was getting sick. And she was about the opposite of Mileva Maritz, in the sense that Mileva Maritz was a brilliant physicist and mathematician, brooding, melancholy, afflicted with schizophrenia. Elsa Einstein was happy, matronly. When they asked her if she understood relativity, she said, no, it doesn't really affect my life, but I'm so glad he understands it. And one thing I think about Elsa Einstein that perhaps other biographers don't agree with me on, I think she's a lot smarter, you know, than she puts on. I mean, she's the one who has the practical smarts. She speaks many languages. She keeps, you know, the logistics for the family, keeps all the bank accounts. She handles all of his speaking engagements. She's one of those smart, savvy, practical people, get along with anybody, protect her husband, and pretends to be just the you know, somebody not too smart, but you know she's solid and smart, and they had a solid relationship.
Well, in fact, you said, based on your understanding, is that they liked each other, they understood each other, and they were amused by each other.
They were amused by
each
other.
And I think the amused, meaning that they could entertain
each other. They both had a good sense of humor. They entertained each other, and that's why I say it was important, because I think they had a more solid relationship than, you know, even Einstein complained at times and said, I failed at both marriages or something. I think he really liked Elsa, and Elsa really liked him, and they were a pretty solid partnership.
Well, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Walter Isaacson. I almost called you Walter Einstein. Walter Isaacson. Walter Isaacson, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Einstein, His Life and Universe. And our guest has also written two other biographies, one of Benjamin Franklin called Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and then also one of Henry Kissinger, that one called Kissinger, A Biography. And our guest is president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. Much more to talk about after this short break as we continue our discussion talking about Albert Einstein, his life and his universe. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Gordon Theater supports WHYY, presenting noted composer Philip Glass on Sunday, April 29th at 8 p.m. in a performance from his Works for Solo Piano. Before the performance at 6 p.m., Philip Glass leads a pre-show discussion on the art and theory of film scoring, which is open to the public. The Gordon Theater is located at 3rd and Pearl Streets at the Ben Franklin Bridge, Camden, New Jersey. For more information, 856-225-2700 or gordontheater.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Alberto Gonzalez is scheduled to testify before Congress about his role in the firing of 8 federal prosecutors. We'll listen in. Also, a brand new Tolkien novel, and you thought he had passed. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents Modern Masters April 25th through 29th at the Merriam Theater.
The program includes the return of Kevin O'Day's Quartet for Four and company premieres of Val Canaparoli's Lamborghini and Twyla Tharp's In the Upper Room. Lamborghini blends the music of Bach and West Africa, celebrating the universal language of dance, April 25th through 29th. For tickets, 215-336-2000 or paballet.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Back with our conversation with Walter Isaacson, and we're talking about his new book called Einstein, His Life and Universe. And we've got calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you think Einstein's theories about the universe, or unified theory, or his other theories as well, are tied to his thoughts about religion?
Yes, he had what he called a cosmic religion. He did not believe in a personal God, meaning you couldn't pray and say, please make it a snow day tomorrow, I didn't study
for didn't do my homework.
In fact, he used to say, for some people, miracles are evidence of God's existence. For me, it's the absence of miracles that's evidence of God's existence, because I feel a cosmic religion when I, with the sense of awe that I feel about the laws of the universe and how elegantly they control things.
Someone asked him, or he said somewhere, that the word he used to describe his faith was mosaic. Was that
when he had to put his religion, and he put mosaic, meaning
right.
Jewish. He was not a practicing Jew, but when anti-Semitism starts to rise in Germany, really in the 1920s, he becomes more and more identified with his Jewish heritage, because as somebody who is a nonconformist, he doesn't try to assimilate. When somebody's, you know, hurting the Jews, he identifies with the underdog.
I'd love to have you read a paragraph there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll read this paragraph because people keep saying, what did you... Yeah. He was at a dinner party once, and people were stunned that he said, I'm not an atheist. I'm not an atheist. People keep claiming I'm an atheist, but I do believe in God. I believe in a cosmic religion. He said, we're like children who enter a library and notice the books, and we try to understand that the books may have been written and they must have been ordered, and that to me is like a cosmic religion. And he also talked about, he'd say, the spirit manifests in the laws of the universe. Spinoza's God, he talked about. That was his God. And at one point, they said, okay, can you put it in one paragraph? And he composes a credo called What I Believe. He said, the most fundamental emotion we can experience is the mysterious. It is the emotion that stands at the cradle of all true art and science. He, to whom this emotion is a stranger, can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe. That person is as good as a dead snuffed out candle. To sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our minds cannot grasp, whose beauty and sublime nature reaches us only indirectly. That is religiousness. That is my religion. In this sense, and only in this sense, I am a devoutly religious man.
I really like that paragraph. And, I mean, interestingly, he doesn't use the word God.
Yeah. But he uses the word God a lot in his life, even in his science, where, you know, Niels Bohr keeps coming up with quantum uncertainty and probabilities of being underlying nature. And Einstein repeatedly says, you know, I cannot believe that God plays dice with the universe. God wouldn't play dice with the universe. Finally, Niels Bohr at one of the conferences says to him, Einstein, please quit telling God what to do. You know, people would say, well, he just used God as a figure of speech. But he would say, no, the old one, which he sometimes referred to. That, to me, when I am trying to come up with a scientific theory, I ask myself, is this the way that God would have painted it when he was creating the universe? So I don't think we should assume that he was being disingenuous. You know, after this paragraph that I just read you comes out, people are still slightly confused. There's a cardinal in Boston who sort of says, give us in 25, you know, tell us, it smacks of atheism because it's an impersonal God. So Rabbi Goldstein in New York, one of the leaders of the Reform movement, sends a telegram saying, tell us, in 25 words or less, Einstein, do you or do you not believe in God? Answer paid. Einstein doesn't even use up the 25 words. No. He just says, I believe in Spinoza's God, whose spirit is manifest in all the laws of the universe.
Which says a lot, and it probably didn't satisfy people looking for a very specific answer to that question.
It doesn't satisfy a whole lot of people who want that specific answer, but you know what? It would have satisfied Ben Franklin. It would have satisfied Thomas Jefferson. And it would have satisfied most of us when we think that concept of deism, even if that's not where we are right now, we've at least understood that. Maybe the cardinal can't understand it. Maybe the lead rabbi can't understand it. But that notion of a deist, impersonal creator that is we can revere and is deserving of awe, and we just don't understand, it's a bit mysterious. I think most normal people can understand that.
Let's get to our callers. And again, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Talking today with Walter Isaacson about his new book called Einstein, His Life and Universe. We've got Lee from Haddonfield. Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'm sort of curious about Einstein's relationship with his friends. You've told us about his family, but his friend Grossman, whose father got him the job at the patent office, was sort of interesting. And Grossman is the one who developed the tensor analysis with which he used to state his theory. And I always wondered how he got along with Grossman. Can you have any idea on that?
Thanks,
absolutely.
Lee.
Yes, it's a very good question, Lee, because you know, some people think that Einstein was cold and aloof and a bit of a loner. Einstein had really close friends, and he's got two great friends in Switzerland in those years, Michele Besso and Marcel Grossman. Grossman, as you say, is even the more interesting. Grossman, they meet at the Zurich Polytech. Einstein, being a lazy dog, as the professor of math at the Zurich Polytech calls him, doesn't even attend half of the math lectures, but Marcel Grossman takes notes for him. And Einstein says, I never would have passed math if Grossman hadn't taken the notes for me. Then when Einstein cannot get a job, it's Grossman's dad who finally gets him the job as a third-class examiner in the patent office. But most important, as you pointed out, Lee, when Einstein decides he needs to come up with the general theory of relativity, and he can picture it, he can picture how acceleration and gravity are equivalent, and he can picture even how gravity is a curving of space and time, but suddenly he realizes he should have gone to math class, because he needs the mathematics, the tensor calculus that can describe, can give you the equations, can give you the good Lord's brushstrokes for how to paint that curvature of space and time. So he gets back to Zurich, and he goes to see Grossman, Marcel Grossman, the old friend still by his side, and says, Grossman, you have to help me or I'll go mad. And he explains the problem of the curvature of space. And Grossman explains Riemannian geometry and goes through the tensor calculus with us. Riemann and Ricci and all these people who had been doing topology in this wonderful new forms of geometry. And it's really Grossman who leads them to the right mathematics to express general relativity.
Lee, thanks for the question. Let me get Chuck from Marlton, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead, your radio time.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. My question is a follow-up about the God, and that is, what do you think Einstein would think about the current scientists, which it seems all of them, with the exception of, I think his name's Dr. Collins, who worked on the Gene Project, every scientist I've ever heard seems very emphatic and says, there is no God. What do you think Einstein would say to that?
Well, it'd be easy to know what he thinks. I do a whole chapter on Einstein and God because there were emphatic scientists of the time. And he writes a very beautiful, long essay called Science and Religion. And he writes about 20 different pieces right after he turns 50, basically 1929 to 1935. And I guess maybe when you turn 50, you start reflecting on the Almighty and the ultimate things. But he says that there's no conflict between religion and science. But he says that's only the case if you're not the type of person who believes in a religion where miracles just happen. Mm-hmm. He believes that scientific laws are immutable, that we shouldn't go around thinking that, you know, the Red Sea parts and it defies all scientific explanation. So he had this notion of a deistic, somewhat impersonal, cosmic religion. And he also said, especially there's a wonderful Berlin dinner party where I start the Einstein and God chapter, and we have the diary of recounting it of that night of somebody who was there. But he says, you know, we should be awed and humbled by our lack of knowledge of how it all started, about what the Creator might be. And anybody who really tries to get dogmatic and say they're absolutely sure, that's not right. it should be a cause of humility, not a cause of arrogance or certainty.
And do you think it's also connected with his curiosity about the unseen? I mean, that's in many ways what drove his scientific curiosity, about the things that you couldn't see but existed in the world.
Right, from age 4 or 5 when he gets that compass.
Right.
And he says, there. Ever since then, he said, there were unseen. You know, I was awed by the unseen forces that controlled nature. And he very often used the phrase, the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit in the face of which we must be awed and we also must be humble. And so to me, that informed his scientific thinking, but also gave him a bit of humility when everybody else told him they knew exactly what God was and or wasn't, or there was no God, or there was a God who did this. I think he just kept a respectful awe and humility.
Let me pick up on a couple of chapters, later chapters in his life. He comes to America to live in, what, 1933?
Right. He first comes in 1921 on a visit with Chaim Weizmann to raise money for Hebrew University and for Jewish refugees. Then comes back a few times to teach at Caltech for a semester as a visiting lecturer. And eventually, he's in Caltech in March of 1933, having made a statement that was wrong, which is Hitler will never amount to much once Germany gets its senses back, he'll be forgotten. But in March of 1933, he realizes he was wrong. Hitler takes power. So Einstein sails back to Europe, but doesn't go back to Germany. He stays in Belgium for a few months, trying to figure out what to do. And then he's been offered a job at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton. End of 33, he moves to Princeton for the rest of his life.
And is he happy with America?
He loves America.
He loves America.
Now, he loves America and also is fully aware of its flaws, which, you know, sometimes rankle him. But he says that America is a place where the freedom is connected to creativity, where free thoughts and free minds. He has been escaping oppression his whole life, running away from Germany as a 17-year-old, running away from Germany again in his 50s when Hitler takes power. He's horrified, mortified by the rise of McCarthyism because he thinks it's like the rise of Nazism, people suppressing free thoughts and free minds. But then Eisenhower, Edward R. Murrow, they all come along, and normal people kind of put McCarthy in his place, and he recedes. And Einstein writes to his son, Hans Albert, he says, you know, America has all these passions, but there's an inner gyroscope there, and it keeps writing itself. And he says, you know, he did a speech or a radio address right after he had applied for citizenship, taken the test, passed, get sworn in, of why I'm an American. And it was about that connection between freedom and the ability to have a great imagination.
And interestingly, he became a pacifist later in life.
Well, he became a pacifist, actually, starts in World War I. He's like the only professor at the University of Berlin who's a pacifist opposing the fatherland in Germany's fight in World War I, then becomes much, much, much more of a pacifist, the head of the War Resisters League. Throughout the 1920s, he's not only a pacifist, he calls himself a radical, absolute pacifist, saying nobody should ever join the army, nobody should ever contribute to the military. And then, now I live in Washington now, you may think, you know, it's a strange city. In Washington, they don't quite get the fact that there should be a correlation between factual evidence and general theories. That there should be facts and ideology should be correlated. When Hitler takes power in March of 1933, he changes his ideology. He says, I'm no longer a pacifist. And the War Resisters League is furious. They can't believe this. He says, no, no, no. If I were a young man now, I would enlist in the army because fighting against oppression, against fascism, is something we all have to do. So he writes the famous letter to Franklin Roosevelt saying, you know, E=mc². Well, now there's some people who've come along that show how you can do a nuclear chain reaction. And the letter says this could be used in the construction of bombs. And Germany may be using uranium from the Congo to get it out. And we've got to start a project to build bombs.
But regretted what?
And then the bomb gets dropped in 45, and famously he learns that Germany wasn't building a bomb. And he has sort of a regret, but what he mainly has is a feeling of now we have to control nuclear weapons, and we have to have a global human system that understands we can never use these weapons again. So he becomes very politically active in the arms control movement.
And part of this unified world government. And it makes you wonder whether that's also connected to this, you know, unified theory of the universe, where
good
he
question.
Was looking for some kind of order here on Earth.
Both in his politics and in his professional science. He always looks for sort of that unifying theory.
Yeah.
He believed in world federalism. There should be universal laws governing the nations of this earth, especially in an atomic age. And that we had to have laws, we had to have a sort of a universal field almost, and he called it a world federalism. And I think he liked bringing things together. That's why he wanted a general theory of relativity. He wanted to apply to all forms of motion. So I think when he saw things that were disunified, he wanted them unified.
And we're almost out of time here. He dies, what, 1955 at the age of 76?
Yeah, he's in bed in the Princeton Hospital. His aneurysm is broken. He's still working on the two things that matter to him most. He's asked to give a speech for Israel Independence Day. He says, fine, but I'm going to give a speech about world peace, not just about Israel. And he reaches over to his bedside table and writes the first line, which is, I speak to you today not just as an American and not just as a Jew, but as a human being.
Hmm.
And then the pain becomes so great, and he puts the speech aside. But again, he reaches to his bedside table and pulls a sheaf of calculations, pages that still have mathematical crossouts and mistakes, writing one last line of equations, hoping, as he tries to get that unified field theory, that maybe one last line of equations will get us closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe.
Seems like a perfect ending to his life.
Well, he died happy and satisfied, and his life is certainly an inspiring one.
Well, thank you, Walter Isaacson, for joining us today.
Marty,
time.
It's so great to be with you again.
Well, thank you so much. And the book is called Einstein, His Life and Universe. I'm Marty Moscowen. Now go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email and find out more about the program. And you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And let me add that our
support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.